Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, and I'm here for the next couple hours talking about cars and car repair stuff. And you're welcome to join us if you like, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. I'm an ASE Master Certified Technician. I've been in the car repair business since 1968 when I worked at a gas station. 1979, I opened up my own shop, and today I own my own shop. I know right from wrong. I work for insurance companies, law enforcement, and certain lawyers with respect to disputes around and centered around car repair. I just want to tell you right now, my butt is on fire like you can't believe. I got some information yesterday that is just, well, you can decide for yourself. Here's the deal. There's been a couple of companies that have come in and purchased big auto repair shops. They've purchased friends of mine shops. They've retired these guys. There is a percentage of a number, EBITDA, and that percentage times the factor, that's the amount that they write him the check for. The owner walks out the door, and the owner gets to keep the building and the land, and he collects rent, and hopefully he doesn't have a mortgage on it, and that means the rent goes to him. All that stuff's happening at a very fast and rapid rate. There's lots and lots of shops in town that have been bought by one of two big companies that is now focused on Phoenix. So a friend of mine calls me the other day, and he says, can I bring my truck to you? And I said, sure, what's the matter with it? And he goes, well, it's got a little bit of a mess. And I said, okay, yeah. I said, we're about 10 days out. And I said, but you can, you know, make an appointment and bring it in, and we'll do the best we can. And he said, well, I just had it into another shop, and, oh, boy, I just want to just shoot myself sometimes. And I say, oh, well, what did they say? And he sent me the repair order, and so I'm going to tell you, this is what it says. The customer says that there's a misfire when the engine gets warm. It doesn't have it when it's cold. And then they go on to explain, here's the end of the deal. The end of the deal is the customer went and gets his truck. His truck is not fixed, and the bill is $924. $924.36. It's not fixed. They don't know what's wrong with it. They didn't tell him they knew what's wrong with him. They didn't give him an estimate for the repair of the truck. They did a bunch of testing. They did sell him a battery. They did a bunch of testing, and the bill for $924, and he leaves there, and the truck runs the same as it did before. He has a new battery in it, and that's all he's got. This is probably the biggest ripoff I have seen in 10 years, and I'm going to read it to you because it's real simple to read. They start off with, they say, the tech used his scanner to see which cylinder was causing the issue, but it does not show which one it is. Well, that's because he don't know how to use his scanner, or he's got something that he paid $200 for instead of $2,000 for. I don't know, but that's a crazy notion. He did find that the odd number cylinders are 10 psi fuel pressure lower than the even cylinders. Now, I'm quite sure, and I've contacted shop owners all morning long, nobody has the ability to do what that sentence says, but Here's the correct way to put this in there. Somebody wrote it up wrong. Somebody said it wrong. But he says that he looked at his scanner, and he can see a difference in pressure between the lower and the higher numbers. It's not pressure. It's percentage of participation. Percentage of participation. You got a V8 motor, and the computer's monitoring the motor running, and it's got one cylinder that's not hitting on. The spark plug's bad, whatever. So as the motor runs, all the other cylinders are hitting 99%, and this one's only hitting 10%, 12%. It has nothing to do with the way they wrote it up, which when he talks about PSI, it's not PSI. He's got a 10% participation on one of the cylinders, and he doesn't even know which one it is. So they write it up, and this is what they say. And they say, first of all, the diag charge is $165. That's part of this $924 bill. The diag charge is supposed to tell you what's wrong with your car. It's not supposed to be, let me look and see, oh, I can't tell, I'm sorry, you owe me $165. That's not the way it's supposed to be. they did. He did tell them that he had to jumpstart the battery. Please test it, and they did. They did that. They tested the battery and they replaced the battery for $282. The battery test alone was $82.50, which is quite high, much higher than the average person would charge in town. But it's kind of in the middle, so it's on the three-quarter mark of where you're at. So it's got a $200 battery in it, and to be specific, it's $199.99, and then $82.50 to replace the battery. So they did that. You remember that I said that they replaced the battery because they had to disconnect the cables, and that has placed further down the list here. So then they decide that they've got a problem, and they can't knows what it is. They don't even represent it correctly on the work order. So they're going to do a fuel injection flush, and we're going to do it not once but twice. We're going to use a super-duper cleaner and then a super-super-super-duper cleaner. So we're going to do it twice. So the injector, on the injector flush, we've got $125 in labor, but one of the injector flushes is $89.99 in parts, and the other is $75 in parts. So the injector flush cleaner and labor is $289. Now, they didn't do anything to the motor. They didn't make it better, and they didn't make it worse. They did nothing to further the repair of this car, the diagnosis and repair of this car. Then here's the one that's the kicker. This is the one that's got my panties wadded up so bad, I can hardly talk. They reset the fuel adaptives. Okay, now most of you have a car with a dashboard that's digital, and you probably have a fuel economy button on there. Your average fuel economy is 26, and there's a reset button. Okay, that's what they did, and they charged him $82.50. Now, when he had his scanner, and he charged him for the scanner work, when he had his scanner plugged in, there's one button you just push that says reset adaptives. That's it. You push it. You got it plugged in, you push it. But no, they charge him on the diagnostic part, they charge him $165, but then they turn around and charge him in another $82 to push the button. That makes no sense at all. You can push the button. He could have done it from the dashboard to reset, and in there it's your average fuel economy, your instant, and your overall long-term average. Those are the kinds of adaptives that it's going to replace. So you can do that in your car. And if you wanted to do it, you take the battery cables off the battery, touch them together, count to two or three, put them back on. You always put positive on first and negative on last. So this the pricing structure is so far out of line. And how it was represented, and how is it that you, the customer, thinks that it's okay? Take your car in. It's got an intermittent misfire. We can see that it's got an intermittent misfire, but we can't find it and we can't fix it. And we're going to put a new battery in it for you, but we're going to charge you $924, and you're going to leave with a new battery, but you're going to leave with the same mess and no diagnosis. And we did do two things, and they were both guesses. Neither one of them fixed your problem. At the end of the day, more than likely, this has a vacuum leak. You'll notice that the even number cylinders are on one side of the block and the odd number cylinders on the other side of the block. There's clearly a difference in participation on one to the other. So we think that there's a vacuum leak. There's a vacuum leak. The EGR valve stuck open. The PCV valve's bad. The line is bad. The booster's bad. There's a lot of different things that you could go in and figure this car out. If you have a little bit of gray hair, you could figure this car out. So at the end of the day, this is the worst I've seen in 10 years. And I can't believe that he, and he's a friend of mine, his name's David, and I can't believe that David is so calm about spending $924.36, and he left there with nothing more than a new battery. No diagnosis. The injector flush did nothing to fix his problem. And they reset the adaptives, which is something that is, again, a push of a button. So this is the worst. Now, what's going on in the industry is we've got these two big companies that are buying shops. And when they buy the shops, now folks, let me explain. When we used to buy a part in the 70s and the 80s, if we bought the part for $5, we'd sell it to you for $6, $7, maybe $8. But rarely was it two times the parts. So that $5 part later on turned into a $10 part. Now, so that's a two times our cost, or one you know, one time our cost. So if you buy something for $20, you sell for $40. That's the way it's been for a long time. Just recently, because of a variety of environmental issues, that is going to go up a little higher, and we're going to have a 2.5 times our cost. But what they're talking about is 5 times their cost. So if they buy something for $10, they're going to sell it for $50. And keep in mind that $10 usually is $20 or $25. But the fact of the matter is, and then it makes a difference on where you buy it. Some of the parts houses are going to give you a deep cost, and then your list price comes down because you can get your margin. On the dealership side, when we buy something from a dealership, oftentimes we get a 10% discount. So if it's a $200 part, we might get a $20 discount. We pay $180 for it. Well, we really can't sell it and warranty it for $20. So many of us will mark that dealer price up. And you can do that yourself. You can figure out what it is. If the shop puts the part number on the work order, you can Google that part number and do whatever you want to do with it. But the idea is that the last guy who installs it is going to have to warranty that part. And so he should really make the most money on it because his risk is bigger than the guy that sold it to him. Because the guy that sold it to him, all he has to do is replace the alternator. So you put an alternator on, it failed. Put another alternator on. Salem's going to cover the warranty or the labor on it, and you just cover the part. We're all whole. But Salem doesn't sit there with a whole bunch of money that doesn't share it with everybody else that's in the food chain when the alternator fails. So be careful with shops that have recently come under new ownership, because we're seeing that the labor rates are going between 175 and 200. And I want to raise my hand and tell you that we just raised ours to 175 because we just did a complete analysis of everybody within a 5-mile radius of us, and we found out that we're $3 higher than the average. And I think we're $3 higher than the average. So at the end of the day, we're at 175. There's guys out there. We've got a quick lube facility that's, I think, is 186 an hour. A quick lube facility. On a 1 to 10 scale, his window of repair might very well be somewhere in the 1 to 3 range or 1 to 4 range, even 1 to 5 range, I'll give him. But at the 5 to 10 range, that's where the big boys shine. That's where you got to have your stuff together. You got to have the equipment. You got to have the knowledge to diagnose and repair the cars. So you have to lie alignment racks, engine analyzers, to tailpipe emissions, to testing equipment, all that stuff. So anyway, now that I'm done and my heart is beating like really fast, I give you this to just warn you that there's big changes in the auto repair industry from the dealerships, the independents, the chain stores, the mom and pops. Everybody's moving around a lot right now. And we're moving around because we follow other people, and because some of these shops have been purchased and they've raised their labor rate, they raised their parts markup and so forth, then the group of us are watching that happen, and we'll pull up underneath them, but there's very few of us that are going to jump on this bandwagon anytime soon. 602-508-0960. Welcome back, everybody. 21 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. I'm not calmed down a bit, but I'm really struggling with this. I want to comment a couple other things on the diagnostic of this. When we do diagnostics on your car, our job is to identify the problem, identify the symptom, and then identify the problem, and then bid the problem to repair. So that's the process. So it's very unusual for us to charge a diagnostic fee, in this case of $165, and tell you at the end of that, we don't know what's the matter with your car. We can't tell you what's wrong with your car. The diagnostic fee is to find the problem, and then you bid the problem, and then you repair the problem. So there's a diag fee, then there's parts, and then there's labor, and we're done. That's really bothersome. In addition to that, we also have something else that just rankles me to no end. Shop supplies is $67 on this ticket. Shop supplies is $67. Now, don't forget that they've flushed it with two very high-quality lotions. They used these lotions to try to flush your fuel injectors because we think it was the fuel injectors, and it really isn't the fuel injection, but we think it was, and we took a very high first-class fuel pack and then another rail cleaner, and the parts on those were $165 for those two flush gizmos, and neither one of those did anything for you either. So the diagnostic of 165 didn't do anything, and then when you start talking about $289.99, and that's for the two cans of cleaner installed in your car plus the labor of is $289.99, you got nothing. You have to be part of the talk on this, and you have to say, okay, your diagnostic, you're going to get to the end, right? And you're going to tell me what's wrong with it and then give me an estimate. And to be honest with you, about 10% of the time, most shops are going to say, yeah, the diagnostic, we're going to charge you $80 because we found it and fixed it for $80. That's really what it happens a lot. You're just too embarrassed to charge $300 for diagnostic because maybe you gave them that window. Well, the diagnostic is 10 to 300. Come on. Most of us know that it's going to take an hour or two, and it can't be more than two hours, depending on what your labor rate is. So those are the kinds of things that just bother you. Shop supplies of $67. They've already charged you for the two lotions to clean up your injectors. What other shop supplies did they use? What else did they do? And usually shop supplies is a derivative of all your parts, but in this particular case, the only thing in parts they had was two cans of rail cleaner, injector cleaner. So at the end of the day, they got $455 in labor, $37 in sales tax, $67 in shop supplies, $364 in parts, and the ticket was $924.36. So I am not applying for a job to fix your car. There are plenty of shops in this town that don't do this. All I'm saying is if your local shop that you've patronized for a very long time has recently sold or changed hands, I would advise you to carefully scrutinize what they say, and I think you'll find that you're going to say to yourself, things have changed. The people have changed, the staff has changed, the verbiage has changed, how they answer the phone has changed, those kinds of things. I'm thinking that this might be just one of the many, but I don't know. But this is clearly well outside industry standards in any way, shape, or form. And we can't charge you almost $1,000 and then tell you that we couldn't find the problem. You just can't do that. You somewhere along the line, you back up and you say, you know, I spent 3 hours. I'm $150 an hour, so I spent 3 hours on it, but I'm only going to charge you an hour because I really didn't find anything, and I really wasn't very useful to you, and you have to wait till it gets worse and easier to find. That's kind of the wrap. That's exactly what you're going to hear. But it's not, your bill is $924, and I can't fix your car, and I tried, and you spent all my guess. I guessed on your money, and I tried to fix it, and I can't, so you owe me $924. But in their defense, there's a battery in there for $200-some-odd that, the battery was $199.99. So that was something that was needed. So the battery and the labor associated with the battery is the only acceptable here that I see. And obviously that's not going to be very much money. At the end of the day, your shop is going to be a chain store, or it's going to be a dealership, or it's going to be a private owner kind of a shop. They all have car repair work that's advantageous to the normal customer. So a chain store is more likely to have specials on cooling system flushes, transmission services, injector flushes, all kinds of stuff, cooling system flushes. There's lots of flushes going on. But the most important part of all that verbiage is you need to open up your owner's manual and look at your owner's manual, because industry, there are a lot in our industry that are telling people that they need to do their flushes at 30,000 miles, but in reality, in the last 4 or 5 years, virtually all the flushes have a 100,000-mile call. So when you talk about cooling system, power steering, brake fluid, transmission, differentials, transfer case, the fluids, almost every car in the last 4 or 5 years has called for 100,000-mile. And here's the difference. Yes, it's true that we used to do those at 30, but that was in the 70s. Today, the fluids are so far superior to the elephant urine that we used in the 70s to put into your car. And it was just one of those things. So our new synthetic oils, and that's really the foothold, is the new synthetic oils and the new synthetic fluids are so far superior to what we put in your car in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and even to some extent in the first half of the 2000s. So there is a difference, but it's your responsibility to look at your owner's manual. And if the shop thinks that they can get away with telling you that you're on a 30,000 mile call on all the fluids, and I don't want to give you an estimate right now because I don't want to scare you, but really it's like $2,000. We could just do one now, and then at your next oil change, we'll do another, and we'll do another. That's kind of what you might hear. And maybe you want to bite on that. It's okay. It's your money. But that's not what the owner's manual says. And the owner's manual says is, and the manufacturer of your car is talking to you through the owner's manual, and they are saying this is what you need to do. There's a lot of shops that are going to look at it and go, well, Arizona's different. To some extent, we are. They might speed it up, but we're not going to go from 100,000 miles to 30,000 miles. It's not going to happen. If we want to classify Arizona, then instead of 100,000 mile, maybe you do it 10,000 miles early, 10% early, even maybe 20% early. Who cares? The fact of the matter is you can justify that, but you can't say the owner's manual is not written for Arizona. It says 100,000. You need to do it at 30. That only benefits one person, and that's the person that just had those words come out of their mouth, because they can sell you three flushes of a fluid in the 100,000 miles when really your owner's manual and the guy that made your car is only calling for one. So those are the things. And, you know, every time you look in your owner's manual, you're going to save yourself money. So if I say to you, I know that it's worth $100 to you if you just read your manual, 99 times out of 100, I'll win that bet. So 602-508-0960. You got a question or a car question or a car problem or a car comment, or if you don't like my rant, I'm okay with that. I mean, you're welcome. You can have time to tell me why I shouldn't have done what I did. Of course, my mother will call me shortly, but at the end of the day, 602-508-0960. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. You're welcome to join us if you have a car question or a car comment. And if you want to deviate from what we've been talking about how shops take advantage of customers, then you want to talk about oil changes, or if you want to talk about my husband says this and I say this, then 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. I have another ticket here in my hand where a customer took his car in because the right front brake caliper moved out of position and locked up the right front tire on his car. So he's driving down the road, and when he goes to apply the brake, then all of a sudden the right front tire locks up, the car kind of swerves to the right, goes, you know, and he gets it into a parking lot, and then he takes it to the shop. When he picks the car up, the bill is $1,394.44. Folks, even in the repair order from the shop, it says the customer heard a clunk and grinding on the right front wheel. Then the wheel locked up. Okay, that's really important, because the clunk is one of the bolts in the caliper came loose. The caliper swung up clockwise. And when it did, it hit the spinning inside of the wheel. Okay? So the caliper has two pins, front, top, and bottom. And those pins hold it in place. And the caliper's job is to squeeze the brake pads and make the brakes work. That's how it works. Well, when one of the pins doesn't get put in right, or with one of the pins breaks, or when one of the pins worked its way out, whatever, then the caliper, when you apply the brakes, the caliper will swing up and it will lock up the right front wheel, the left front wheel, whichever wheel the caliper is now loose on. So he takes it in. 99 times out of 100, when I've seen this, we replace the caliper and sometimes the caliper mount, because sometimes it's broken too. The caliper, the mount, you're going to have to put pads in it, but you're going to get a set for both fronts, so you're going to go ahead and put new fronts, new pads on the driver's side, new pads on the passenger side. So you're going to do kind of a $125 brake job. And then the caliper itself is going to, and that, is going to cost you somewhere in the vicinity of another $125. So you're going to be in the 250 range, and I'm just throwing numbers out there because I'm doing the best I can, because in a generic kind of car. So this is what they did after they write down heard clunk and grind right front wheel locks up. Again, the clunk is the caliper came loose. The grind is the spinning wheel is now being shaved. The aluminum wheel is now being shaved by the sharp edge of the caliper. And then the right front wheel locked up. Finally, the caliper digs into the wheel real good, and boom, that's it. They charged, they went in and they replaced the caliper right front, and the bill was $124 for the part. And that's good. That's right in the numbers area. Then they replaced the right front caliper, and the caliper itself was $124, and they said $243, and that should include the bleeding of the brakes. But then they replaced the hub assembly for $630. They replaced both wheel bearings in the hub assemblies on both driver's side and passenger sides at $343. Then they had a standard diagnostic fee of $48, so the bill's $1,300. There was no reason, there never has been a reason, to replace the hub bearings on both sides because a caliper came loose on the right side or the left side. So if the caliper comes loose on the right front, the passenger side front, that has no effect whatsoever of the wheel bearings on the driver's side. They don't share the same fluid. They don't share the same anything. It has nothing to do with that. So to replace the hubs and the wheel bearings and take this bill to $1,394 is very questionable. Why would you do that? Now, here's the self-defense mechanism for you. Every time you have something like this, you insist at the very beginning, I want all my old parts back. I want you to, they come in boxes, the new parts come in boxes, so you take the box, open the box and put the new part on, but take the old part, put it in the box and put it in the trunk of my car. My husband or my brother, he likes to do autopsies on all that kind of stuff, and I just patronize him and I give him all my old parts back, and he says, I know what happened and stuff like that. But you need your old parts, because this is a very defendable position. Because the shop went way overboard, especially when they stopped working on the right front and transferred its complaints and problems to the left front. There's no relationship there. None at all. It's like having a flat tire on the right front and they want to replace all the rest of the three tires.
1 minute.
Doesn't make sense. So, anyway, these are the kinds of things that I get in the newspaper, and I figured today would be the day that I would rant and rave about the worst of our industry. I want to tell you, though, I would venture a guess that 60 to 65% of all the shops in the valley are good guys. They try hard. They work well. They know the customer. They have good customer base. They've been around a long time. But that leaves about 30% of them out there that they have a swimming pool they got a mortgage and a swimming pool payment. They got some kids in college and they don't have enough work. And so then they make up the work and then they start selling you stuff to pad their wallet and take money out of your wallet and put it in their wallet. And it's parts and labor that you don't need, you didn't need, but unfortunately they sold it to you. So that's why you ask for your old parts back. You always ask for your old parts back. And you say to them, put them back in the box that you got the new ones out of and just put them in the trunk of my car. My brother, my husband, my brother's husband, my husband's brother, whatever. Make up a story. Just get the parts. And that's the easy part. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. There's five lines open. You got a car question, car problem, give me a call. 43 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. Let's go to the phones. Mike's on the phone. Mike, how are you today? What can I do for you?
I'm great, Mark. Really enjoyed the show.
Thank you.
I was calling. I've got a 1965 Mustang I just bought a little bit ago, which seemed pretty fun, and it was running really good when I got it. And we went on vacation for a couple of weeks, came back, and there was no fuel getting delivered to the carburetor. So I changed out the fuel filter. It was clogged up. Still no fuel, was able to get the blow out to all the fuel lines and, get fuel running back through the electric fuel pump. And now it's running too rich. It won't run. It's running like a dream when I bought it. So I'm trying to figure out what I should approach next.
Okay. So, yeah, after it sat for a while, you cranked it over and it wouldn't start and you determined that the absence of fuel was causing the no start condition.
Correct.
Okay. And did you do that like by using carburetor spray and spraying the intake, and it started up, and then it ran for a second and died, and you go, okay, 1 and 1 equals 2?
Well, I looked in there. There was no fuel, and when I bought it, there was a clogged up fuel filter in the trunk, so that was kind of an indicator. So I bought a clear fuel filter,
okay,
and it was getting no fuel to it when I put that in. So I blew out all the lines and was able to get fuel running back into the electric fuel pump that way.
Okay, now, your 65 Mustang didn't come with an electric fuel pump. Is it mounted on the rail of the frame? Is it in the back of the car? Is it in the front of the car?
No, it's mounted up high where it shouldn't be.
Okay.
It's in the engine compartment, pretty far above the fuel pump, or above the fuel line, I mean to say.
Well, it doesn't really make any difference how high or how low an electric fuel pump is. It can be anywhere you want it to be. When you turn the key to the on position.
The Holley pump, when I looked up the specs online, it said it should be at or below the fuel tank outlet. So that's on the long run project of trying to get that probably in the right place.
But, well, if it's an electric pump,
it seems to be running now.
It doesn't. If it's an electric pump, it doesn't make any difference where the heck it's mounted.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference. There's going to be a check valve in there that's going to hold the pressure forward. So it may drain from the suction side of the fuel pump back down to the tank, but as soon as you turn it on, it's going to go like that and pull pressure on it. So does it run and start now, or just crank and not start?
So I can get it started, but I can't get it to stay running at idle, and it's running really rich. So the only other thing I did, I was checking the spark plugs to see what was going on in there, and they were all pretty old and cruddy, so I pulled those out, and really carbon rich, and it looks like it's been running rich for a while.
Okay. It's got a Holley on it?
Yes, four barrel Holley.
Okay. And you say it's running rich, and so is it blowing black smoke, and it's flooding, and you can look down the Venturis, and you can see raw gas going into the motor?
Yes, although the smoke is mostly more of a gray color.
Okay. Well,
lighter color.
Gray is fine. Black is, I mean, that would go hand in hand with your description of it's really running rich, because black is really, really running rich. You could have that the fuel pump is overcoming the needle and seat on the carburetor, and the fuel pump should be set somewhere between 3 and 4 and maybe 5 PSI. And someone should have had a fuel pump that was for that PSI, but if you've got a 15 or a 20-pound fuel pump on there, it's likely to overcome the needle and seat in the Holley carburetor. If that's the case, you could pinch off you could just disconnect the electrical at the fuel pump and start the car up and just kind of nurse it along, and there will come a time when the float level drops down and it stops flooding internally. And when you do that, then all of a sudden it'll run real good. You rev it. Everything's fine. Just stay there. Don't go anywhere, because you'll be walking home, and you just stay there, and pretty soon the bowls will run empty. And when they run empty, you pump it a couple times and it dies, and you go, okay, well, there's a sweet spot in that bowl where this is too low and this is too high. The too high causes black smoke and it runs rich, and the too low causes it to die. So I know that my float's good in the carb. And so now I have to just figure out how come I'm overcoming the needle and seat from the electric fuel pump. What part of town do you live in?
Tempe, luckily.
Okay. Most everybody I know right now is 5 to 10 days out. I know that we're 10 days out, but that's not a tough thing for some old gray-haired guy with gray hair creeping out of the neck of his T-shirt, because we all were born and raised on those kinds of things. But I would be interested. You have a rubber line that goes to the Holley. I'd be interested if you put a pair of needle-nose pliers on that rubber line. You got it running. Kind of pinch it off and hold it there. Get it running until it will run by itself. And then let go of the needle nose, and that should flood it again. And if that's the case, and now it floods again, then it'll die. Then what we have to do is we got to get all the trash out of the tank. And it sounds like we've got gas coming out of the tank. It's going through the pump, and the filter's not taking a lot of the trash out, or you have too much pressure and we're overcoming the needle and seat. So have you ever taken the top off of a Holley carburetor?
I have not.
Okay, I wouldn't do it if I were
you. It's something I'm going to be doing.
Yeah. It's,
well, I'm wanting to learn. That's why I bought the car. I just got a little quicker than I was hoping to.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to ease into it a little bit.
A lot of us will just pop the top off the Holley and look at it, and we're going to look at the needle and seat on the float, and if it's full of trash, then we know we got to go backwards, and that's our work's going to be between the carburetor inlet and the fuel tank. On the other hand, if everything's really good and clean, then we're going to put everything back together, put a pressure gauge on it, and find out what kind of PSI we're pushing forward. We know that we needed 2 or 3, maybe 4, but we don't want 5 to 10. Not at all. And those are the kinds of things. But your Holley carburetor, now I know that all the Mustang guys that are my friends right now, they know what I'm going to say. But I don't like Holley carburetors. We work on those all the time. All the time. The power valve goes bad. They flood. They have air leaks. I mean, it's crazy. There's a lot of other carburetors that you could put on there that would give you the power and performance without the Holley. And it's entirely possible. It's just sitting on a V8, right? 289, something like that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, that could be a 400, 500, 600, 700 CFM Holley, and it could be made for a motor that's got twice the horsepower and breathes twice as much air as what you have. So there's those kinds of moving parts. I don't know what
to at least get it driving around before I have to take it to the mechanic.
Yeah, yeah, I think well, the question is it's running rich. Clearly, it's running rich. So is the needle and seat got trash in it? Or is the fuel pump too heavy or too much pressure for the system? Those are the two things. Because that's the check valves. We're going to pressurize the system, and the needle and seat's going to fill up the bowl, and then it's going to shut it off. Fill up the bowl, and then shut it off. And it's going to keep the gas level inside the bowl at a pretty one-line area. So, I mean, the diagnostic on this could be... Boy, the diagnostic on this could be $100 to $200, but the good news would be this. There is a 50-50 chance that the diagnosis costs you $125 and the repair costs you $10. There's a possibility of that because you'd find it and fix it at the same time. So those are the things that that you're up against. What part of Tempe do you live in?
We're Guadalupe and McClintock, so we're not too far from you guys.
Okay. Well, if we happen to be your choice, just call and get an appointment. And another thing you could do is you can ask permission to bring the car in even though you're 10 days out, and then you would be susceptible to the opening that became available. So if there was two cars in front of you that were there waiting for their turn, they'd be in front of you, but after the third no-show, then it would be you. So that's kind of what everybody's doing, and I think that's what we're doing as well.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, we'll follow up with a couple of those ideas, and then probably most likely be seeing you guys soon.
Okay. Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
You bet. 602-508-0960 if you have a car question or a car problem. I can guide you. And there's three answers to the questions: yes, no, or I don't know. Now, the women have no problem with yes, no, and I don't know, but the guys, for whatever reason, and I'm one of them, sometimes we just don't know how to say, I don't know. And that's a good answer because then at least we don't go off on the wrong tangent. Old cars right now are pretty popular. There's a lot of guys that drove Mustangs and Camaros and Roadrunners and Dodges and stuff like that can now afford to own one again. And, of course, the technology is Fred Flintstone era compared to the port fuel injected, sequential port fuel injected, variable valve timing, and hot rod motors that we have today. The 283 and the 327, the small block Chevys and Fords, and small block is the small V8s. That's what they call a small block. Those things had between 165 and maybe 195 horsepower. We have four-cylinder motors in the small import cars that have twice that horsepower. And it's just a completely different animal in how we deliver fuel, and when we spark. Do we hit the spark early? Do we hit the spark late? What the emissions are involved in? Where your foot's at? How much vacuum the engine has at this particular point? Because of all the computers and all the inputs to the computer can make an intelligent decision on what to do next. So in the old days, you have points and condenser, and in Mike's case, his carburetor's flooding, and the question that I gave him was, are we pumping too much pressure forward, or do we have a needle and seat problem in the carburetor? And that's kind of how it works. And we have a caller?
Yes, say hello to Scott.
Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Here's what I got. I've got a 2004 Chevy Silverado. It's got about 260,000 miles on it. It's my daily driver. It's my work truck. And I've maintained it pretty well. Well, it just died on the highway a few weeks ago. And I had it towed. They couldn't diagnose it. Had it towed to another shop, and they found out there was water in the fuel tank, quite a bit. And he said it was probably done on purpose because there was so much in there. Well, so they had to pull a fuel tank. You know, there's $1,000. I had a new fuel pump put on recently, and it was getting pressure to the engine. Well, they cleaned out the system, but it ended up with it's running, but there's one cylinder. It's a 4.3 liter V6. One cylinder that he said there was the ring, probably from the water, caused the piston ring to go bad. So it's firing on five cylinders right now. It's running rough. So I need to know if there's anything I can do about that or if I should put a new engine in there.
Well, I can't answer some of those questions, but I can tell you I wish you would have called your insurance company for the car when you found out that somebody, it looks like, and the shop's going to testify that the tank's full of water and looks like somebody stuck a hose in there. Could have been a neighborhood kid. It could have been your wife's boyfriend. It could have been somebody that doesn't like you. Whatever the reason is, that's covered under your insurance if you have a comprehensive policy, if you have more than liability. And the insurance companies hire guys like me to go out there and look at the car. Yep, the tank's full of fuel. Yep, it's something that is a big time deal. And so they pay for it all, but your deductible. And what needs to happen is we need to identify what is going wrong. And this is a 2004, so I'm assuming that 4.3 is fuel injected, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Now that's a throttle body on top of that. It's got a carburetor looking throttle body on the top of the motor. So the two injectors there feed all six cylinders. I don't think you have port fuel injection where you have six individual injectors on the intake runners on that 4.3. I could be wrong. It's going to be one or the other. It's going to have a throttle body on the top with two injectors on it, or it's going to have one injector for each cylinder. Either way, this is on a 1 to 10 scale for gray-haired guys and ASE Master certified technicians and stuff. On a 1 to 10 scale, this is a 3 or a 4 diagnosis. It's no big deal. I don't know what the bill's going to be. But if it's got a bad injector, sometimes you just pop the injector out and swap it with the cylinder next door, and then you start it up, and if the problem moves next door, then it's the injector.
I think that's what he did. He did replace one of the injectors.
But it still runs bad, and now he's blaming it on the pistons and the rings.
Well, he said they did. They tested that with somehow.
He probably did a wet. Did he say anything about a wet-dry compression test?
He did a compression test, but he didn't tell me what type. So.
Okay, so what happens is if we think the rings are all boogered up or if we think they're broken, then we run a compression test, then we squirt some oil into the cylinder, and then we run another compression test, and if the compression comes up dramatically, then the rings are a problem. That's what a wet and dry compression test is. So it's a diagnostic process. So really and truly what has to happen now is somebody just has to figure out why we're not hitting on one cylinder. And now, don't eliminate spark plug wire, distributor cap.
He replaced all those.
Oh, God almighty. There's no reason to replace this stuff. We have the ability to test it. We have the ability to check to see what kind of KVs we got out of the spark plugs and stuff like that. There's no reason to guess. This is a Fred Flintstone car. This is a car that all of us older guys. What part of town do you live in?
North Scottsdale.
Okay, I'd probably go to Combs Automotive, Combs COMBS, or go to Blackwell. And either one of those two guys, I can tell you right now, either one of those two guys, they aren't going to guess. They're not going to have to guess at all. They're going to go in, find the problem, and call you with an estimate. So I don't know if it needs a motor or not, but if they do, they'll tell you, yes, it needs a motor, here's why, and here's it is, and here's some pictures, because we dropped a camera down on the motor and took pictures for you. That's the best I can offer you. If you want to stay and talk some more, stay right there. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes. Well, welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. Gil, who's my, he's flying the airplane. If we get a caller, then just tap on my ear real hard, and then that way I'll know. But right now I'm going to talk about Scott. Scott had called in last hour, and he has an 04 Silverado Chevy pickup, and it died in flight. And it's fuel injected, by the way. And he took it into a repair shop, and the shop said that the tank had been filled with water, according to what they found. And so I would assume they took the tank out, cleaned it out, emptied all the water out of it, put in gasoline, and then replaced the fuel filter, and then followed it all the way, the fuel flow to the front. They probably disconnected a couple of lines until gas came out and no more water. And then at that particular point, they reconnect everything, and it should start up. There's really nothing, when you think about this, think about this with me, okay? He puts somebody, somehow or another, he ends up with a whole bunch of water in the fuel tank. The kids could have been messing around with the hose. It could be that one of his neighbors doesn't like him. I don't know, and I don't care. But the fact of the matter is when that vehicle was parked last, it had fuel throughout the entire fuel system. He went out to drive it, and he cranked it over, and he couldn't get it running. And if the tank had been contaminated with water, now we have water in the fuel system, and it's not going to run. Water's not going to cause any problems. Water's not going to cause the motor to need a new one. It's not going to cause any kind of problems. It's not running. It won't run on water. Yes, it will try to compress the water, and of course, water will not compress. Air will compress, but water won't. And that usually just locks the motor up on a temporary basis. So you pull the spark plugs out of it, you shut off the fuel pump, you empty the tank, you put gasoline in it, and you just crank it with the spark plugs out of it and just blow all the water out of the motor. So this is really kind of simple. This is not something that is going to cause or should not cause the engine to fail, because one of Scott's last questions to me was, he said he had 200,000 miles on this motor. I think it was 200,000 miles. And he talked about, well, should I get a used motor or a rebuilt motor, or what kind of motor should I get? I don't think there's a chance in hell that you're going to need a new motor if this was a water contamination issue where maybe a kid stuck a garden hose in your fuel tank. I can't, because the motor doesn't run on water, so it won't develop RPM. It won't start and run. It won't damage itself. It just won't start. It just has water in it. So if you're going to do something, then find in a low mileage engine, a 4.3, and you'll have to do some research, because this particular engine may only fit 4 model years. So you have to kind of figure out what that is. And you can do that by calling the General Motors dealership and saying, hey, I have an 04 Silverado with a 4.3. How many years spread does that one engine fit? And he may say, oh, from 2000 to 2008, they're all the same part number. Well, there you go. So if you get another used motor out of a 2000 to 2008, and that's the range for the engine that you're trying to replace, then you're home free. Then you just go find one in a used environment, low miles, and with a guarantee. So that's kind of how it works. But this isn't really something that's difficult. Let's get the water out of the motor. Let's get it running, and I guess it is running to some extent right now. If we have a low cylinder, then we want to take the spark plug out of it and its companion and switch the two spark plugs and see if that makes a difference. While we have the spark plugs out, let's go ahead and do a compression test on it real quick. Let's go ahead and look at the tips of the spark plug. They'll tell us a lot, whether there's water inside, whether there's carbon inside, whether the piston's collapsed, whether the valve hit the piston, all that kind of stuff. This is really easy stuff for us old gray-haired guys. So I think you might be wasting a lot of your time if you jump from, I got a tank full of water and I need an engine. Because I think tank full of water and a motor full of water and needing a new engine are so far apart. And I think the odds are that this can be fixed. And I think I'm 90% sure that this can be fixed without a motor. And it'll run as good as it did before this whole calamity started. And then there's a 10% chance that we bent something trying to, and you were cranking it over. You didn't know you had water in it. Water doesn't compress, and we bent a rod, and now you're going to have to replace the motor. So those are the kinds of things. And you know how to tell if you bent the rod. You pull all the spark plugs out of it. You shine a spark plug, a flashlight down the hole, and you have somebody crank it over, and you can see the piston come up and down. Well, if all the pistons are coming up all the way to the spark plug hole and then going back down, you go fine. But one of them doesn't. It comes up kind of close, but then doesn't and goes back down. Well, that's got a bent rod to it. we have a dial indicator that we screw into the spark plug hole, and it tells us what the top dead center mark is. So we just screw that in 6 times, crank it over, boom, we're done. So that's kind of how it works. Thanks, Scott. That was good. A good one. I hadn't had a tank full of water, but it's not too late to let your insurance company know that somehow or another you ended up with a tank full of water, because if it needs a motor, they're not going to put a new motor in there for you. They'll put a used motor in there for you if you have the appropriate insurance coverage, and that's because somebody damaged your car, whoever it was. Anyway, 602-508-0960 if you have a car question or a car problem. You're welcome to give us a call. We have 5 lines. Gil's the one that's snoring in the background. It's been kind of a slow show. We've had Mike and Scott, but you're welcome to join us. Like I said, we have 5 lines, 602-508-0960. Car repair is really much easier than it was in the old days, because the fundamentals are still the same, but we're just looking at a computer, so we can actually interface with the computer, and I'll give you an example. Everything in the – let's just pretend for the demonstration here, everything in your car is 1 to 5 volts. Computers talk in voltage language. So I am the throttle position sensor. I tell the computer where your foot's at. Is your foot completely off the throttle, or is your foot mashing the throttle to the floor? Okay? But I can only talk in voltage language. So you start the car up, and the computer looks at me, and I say 0.9, which is just under 1 volt. And the computer goes, okay, we're idling, and he's perfect. And then I rev it up, and then all of a sudden, the computer sees I go from 1.9 to 3.3 and back to 1.9. Well, I just rev the motor up. And again, voltage language. So then I put it in reverse, I back out, I put it in drive, I mash it to the floor, the computer sees 5, because the voltage range is 1 to 5. So the computer sees 5 and it goes, oh my God, Mark's got his foot on the floor. And he opens the valve up and he starts giving that engine lots of fuel. And he advances the timing and he opens the EGR valve and he does all this kind of stuff in the split 5 times a second, even more. So the computer is constantly looking at engine vacuum, engine RPM, vehicle speed, throttle activity, fuel pressure, timing. It has all of this stuff going on, but it talks in voltage language. So there is no yes or no or hi, how are you. Low is 1 and high is 5. Just remember that. Low is 1 and high is 5. So 1 says you're idling and 5 says your foot's on the floor. That's the throttle position sensor. Now, engine vacuum. Idling, engine vacuum is high. So it would be 5. And wide open throttle, engine vacuum is low. It'd be 1. You see how that works? So the whole computer system on all your cars is based off voltage language. And you just have to figure out how to read it. And that's the way it is. We have a caller. Who might that be?
Say good morning to Jim.
Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Good. Just a quick question, and I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. I just turned 75, and I can remember back in the day, diesel fuel was cheap, and everybody ran out and bought diesels. Now, today, diesel fuel is just unbelievably high, and I was just curious, could you explain to us why that is?
Well, I can tell you that the market for diesel and gas and every other thing like propane and stuff is just driven by demand. And there is those that swear that diesel fuel, let's pretend that from the oil out of the ground until the tank in my diesel truck and yours, let's assume that there's 10 steps. And I'm told that that we take gas or oil out of the ground and convert it to gas, and then we put it in your car, and that's only 5 steps. So from the time we pull this oil out of the ground and we make it gas, there's 5 steps, and by the time we pull this oil out of the ground and we convert it to diesel, there's 10 steps. That's one of the reasons, because the refinement process is quite different. Number two, there is, there's 9 out of 10 cars on the road are gas and 1 out of 10 cars are diesels. So we're going to charge a little bit more money because we're not going to sell as much diesel to the public that we are in gasoline. So it's going to cost more. Now, do you have a diesel that you're feeding a lot of fuel to?
No, I don't. But I have a couple friends that went out and bought diesels and were bragging about how cheap the price was, and now they're kind of crying a lot, you know.
Well, let me step in. And first of all, let me tell you some of the benefits for the diesel. I have a 1-ton Dodge diesel. It can pull much better than any gas motor around. Okay, I can haul horses, I can haul tractors, I can haul bobcats, I can haul excavators, I can haul all that stuff. And many of you out there are going to say, Mark, you're overloaded if you're hauling this big. And to some extent, sometimes around the ranch, there are no highways, and I can do that. The idea is that the diesel has power. It also lasts longer than a gas motor. So it's not uncommon for diesel motors to be in the 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000 mile range, and very few gas motors are going to go there. Number two, the oil changes on diesels, they hold anywhere from 5 to 15 quarts of oil, and the big trucks are even more than that. So the oil changes go 10 and 15,000 miles, and on my Dodge diesel truck, I'm running 10,000 mile oil changes. And I don't have spark plugs. And then I have a catalytic converter. I have a particulate filter. So what's coming out of my tailpipe's pretty clean. So when you look at all of those moving parts, but I'll tell you a secret. Tell your friends this. There is a couple of really good fuel apps that go on your phone. And the other day I looked at the fuel app before I left Payson, and Payson was $4.88 for diesel. And I also have an app that gives me like 3 to 15 cents off the gallon. And they put the money in my account within 10 minutes after I buy the fuel. So anyway, I looked down in Tempe, and there's a Chevron station on Kyrene in the 202 that was $4.22. And I thought, well, I'll just do that because that's right around the corner from my house. So I leave Payson. I drive straight down to this Kyrene. It's on the Indian Reservation, and I get diesel fuel there, and I save myself 60 cents, plus I get another 13 cents back after that. So I felt pretty good about that. And, yes, the prices are all over the board, but if you don't have an app on your phone where you can say, where's the closest gasoline, and tell me the closest one and the best price, you can do that with your phone today and save a lot of money. And Mark and Renee go up and down the mountain a lot, and it's 93 miles from the ranch to our house in Chandler. But I'm at 16 miles to the gallon, and my wife is 14 miles to the gallon. And she drives a Ford Explorer. So when you look at her Ford Explorer, I can tell you right now, she's probably weighing a little bit more than I am, because sometimes I'm running empty. She's also going faster than I am, and she has very little patience, so her foot's on the floor a lot. On my diesel, I'm very much calmer, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah, right.
Anyway, those are the differences, okay?
Well, thank you very much.
All right, you're more than welcome. Gas Buddy is one of the ones that I use. I love Gas Buddy. It just gives you an idea of what the fuel costs are that are around where you live and stuff. Upside is that Gil, is that the one that we hear on the radio a lot?
Upstart.
My wife has Upstart, and not only can she get the cheapest fuel, but then she also gets between 3 and 4 and maybe upwards to 8 and 9 cents discount.
I'm sorry, Mark, it's Upside.
Upside. That's it. Thank you, Gil. The app is Upside. And so she has that on her phone. And so when we go to dinner, I'll say, hey, I need some fuel. And she'll look at her phone and she'll say, go to this Circle K around the corner here. And they have the lowest price, plus we get 11 cents a gallon discount. I say, okay, fine. That's what we do. And like, she'll get on her phone and we'll be driving away from the gas station and she'll say, 11 cents is already there. You had 8 gallons, 11 cents, 88 cents, we're done, and that's how it works. So that's the kind of good thing that we've been doing and we've learned from other people. 602-508-0960, and we'll be right back. 21 minutes after the hour of 11
o'clock. 21 minutes out of the after the hour of 11 o'clock.
Get my high voice and my low voice at the same time. We're going to just go to the phones. Mark, how can I help you?
I have a diesel that is intermittently not started, usually after a 10-15 minute idle time, and then a stop of about 5-10 minutes, and then come back out and they just crank. Let it set for another 10 minutes or so, and then we find the charge.
Okay, tell me what we're talking about. Give me the vehicle information.
Okay.
And I'm having a tough time hearing you, so if you're on Bluetooth or something, maybe you take that off.
Okay. It's a 2004 Super Duty F-150.
Okay. And it's a diesel?
Yes.
Okay. So 2004, is that a 7.3?
No, it's a 6.
Oh, it's a 6-liter. Okay. Obviously, fuel delivery seems to be the problem. And obviously, it has to do with temperature as well. There's no way I can diagnose that without running fuel pressure tests, without attaching different instrumentation to your diesel, and to determine why sometimes it cranks but doesn't catch, and sometimes it catches just fine. It could be, depending on the temperature, and you'll save yourself some money if you can just answer this question. I want you to distinguish between a cold start and a hot start. I want to know if they're the same. Yes, I can start it up hot and drive it, and then I shut it off and I come back a few minutes later and it won't start. Okay, that's a hot. On the other hand, cold in the morning, starts right up. I drive it to work, I park it for a few minutes, I get back on it, and it won't start. Well, that's a cold hot. So that kind of helps us when we do diagnosis. But and, you know, you've got a supply pump that goes through a filter system, and then the filter system goes to the high-pressure pump, and then the high-pressure pump feeds the high-pressure diesel fuel to the injectors, and then we have to cycle the injectors on and off, so we have to go tsk, with the computer. And so if we lose a sensor and we lose a crankshaft sensor, or the computer doesn't know that you're cranking the motor, then it's not going to cycle the injectors. So it could be something in the fuel system, but it could also be a variety of sensors that are preventing the engine from seeing, or the computer from seeing, that that it needs to cycle the injectors on and off. So the diagnostic process on something like that is probably going to be as little as $80 all the way up to $200. It depends on how many places we're going to have to disassemble a connection to put a T in to run fuel pressure tests. So do you have a diesel shop close to you?
Well, I don't know. I'm by GCU, so I've heard some reports of one over in Glendale. I really haven't decided where to take it. I usually do my own work, but this is my first diesel, so I'm willing to take some help.
and you know, I think you just be honest with the shop. I do have some mechanical ability, but I don't have the equipment necessary to query the computer. I don't have a scanner to look at serial stream data. I don't have pressure testing equipment and stuff like that. So let's just do what is it? How much does it cost to just have you kind of do some cursory stuff? Now, what you could do, you could feed it some ether and see if you could get it to start and run on ether. And if you go to a shop and say, it'll start and run on ether for as long as I hold the ether can in the intake hose, but I let go of the stopped spraying ether and then it dies, well, then we have a fuel supply problem. So we've got a low-pressure pump that goes through a filter, and then from there it goes to a high-pressure pump, and then it goes to the injectors. So that will help.
Yeah, I know you're,
go ahead.
I know you're big on what was the symptoms, and the symptoms were the only two that I've had was, like I said, idle time, 15 minutes, and then stopped, and then 15 minutes later it started. Last time, 15 minutes idle time, and then it took over an hour to start.
Okay.
And at that time, it did finally start, but then it only went like a mile or so, because I was only like 2 miles from home. And then it would only idle, and I didn't want to turn it off, and I was able to go through, you know, the neighborhood and just kind of idle home.
Okay.
And but when I got home, that's when I took the chance and restarted, and it started fine.
Okay. You have a fuel starvation problem. So you're not getting sufficient pressure and sufficient volume of fuel to the motor. And so you can use that scenario to dance all you want, but the fact of the matter is that it's going to be easier to just diagnose it. It's going to be easier to put a free fuel pressure gauge on there. It's going to be easier to just follow the fuel from the pump forward, and then you don't have to worry about all that other stuff. But I'm not. I know right now that it's capable of running fine, and I know right now it's not capable of doing 30 miles an hour. It'll run, but it'll just barely run. That doesn't help me figure it out other than coming to the conclusion that it's a fuel starvation problem. It's an absence of fuel pressure. And so I don't know if you've done the filter yet, but I'd certainly, that'd be one of the first things that I'd do, because that the filter can clearly cause that kind of intermittent activity. So I try a filter if I were you. That's the easiest thing to do it, and just make sure that you have the proper equipment to take the filter housing off, and that you monitor your O-rings if there are any, or beveled edges, and make sure everything's nice and clean and all that other kind of stuff, because a little piece of dirt will cause a leak, and you'll chase that leak for the rest of your life. So just try to avoid that.
2 minutes.
Okay? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Keith, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hey, Mark. Love the show. My question is, why did the automakers go from quoting cubic inches to liters?
You know,
that's my first question.
I don't have a clue. You know, 5.7 liter is the same as a 350, and you know, all this other stuff. 6 liters is, I don't know. I don't know. I just deal with the cards that have been dealt with to me.
And
we all, I kind of know, you know, of what a liter conversion is, the 454 and stuff like that, and the 464. But, I don't know. There's a lot of those kinds of questions, that happen every day of my life, and we're going, what were you thinking of? Now, some of the cars, you push the button forward and it opens it, and some of the cars, you push the button forward and it closes it. You know what I mean? The window switch.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. Yeah. I wish Ford and Chevy and Honda and Toyota and Dodge would all just get together and just develop some standards that we could live with. That's what I think. All righty.
That'd be nice. One more thing. I'd like to suggest we start a GoFundMe account to get a new roof for Pete's place.
You know what? I'm happy to stand in the background and watch you do that. Okay? I'm real happy to do. You know, I will support you. Thank you very much, Keith. Hey, oh gosh darn it. My board op. What's your name again?
Bill?
Yeah. Would you get his phone number off of your caller ID? Because I'm going to need to participate in that. We'll be back. And, Jay, you stay there. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour. We're going to go to Jay, and then I've got some comments about our friend Keith, who was talking about liters and cubic inches and something else that he said. But, Jay, I'm not going to make you wait through that. How can I help you, buddy?
I just have two requests. When you say your phone number, say it really slow. For us people that has attempts to reverse numbers, it'll be easier to hear that telephone number.
Okay, and thank you for that. I've had that complaint before, and I need to be reminded on a regular basis, and thank you for doing that. You know, I got to tell you something. If my wife was here, she just left about an hour ago, I wouldn't have done that because she'd have slapped me because she says that you're always too fast with the phone number. So I will do that. I promise.
Thanks. I have a friend that's wanting to buy a Kia Niro new just because the used prices seem to be almost the same. Is there a car service where he can bypass all that, you know, ads that they keep throwing on you? You go to a regular dealer?
You know, I like the idea, and folks, what Jay's thinking is when you go in to buy your car, I just tell him, I'm going to pay... You, how much you want for that? I'm going to pay you that, sales tax, and license plates, and that's it. I'm not paying any dock fees. I'm not paying for an aftermarket warranty. I'm not paying for a window treatment that you put on there that makes the windows fancy-dancy and really pretty. I'm not paying that you put some kind of smell-good stuff underneath the seats so the car smells good all the time. I'm not doing any of that. It's called a pack. We're going to pack the car with line items to make more money. I'm just not going to do that. There's the sticker. The sticker is right there. How much do you want below the sticker? Below is a key word there because they'll laugh. Below the sticker, mm-hmm. And they'll say this, and say that, sales tax and license plates, that's my offer. That's it. I'm not going to, you can load it with fancy dancy window tinting and paint, protectant and special tires and you can put some kind of a machine in there that will detect when somebody passes gas. I don't want none of that. I want just the car. And this is the car that I want. And do it in a nice way. And if I were you, I'd be looking for the gray-haired guy that's been at the dealership a long time, because he'll smile when you say that, because that's not the first time he's heard it.
Okay.
That's what I'd do.
Because I know she went, she's like, I got $25,000 to spend from the insurance company for the car that she wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I just want to go in there, but they keep, you know, they tack on all the prices.
And
I know when I bought mine, it was the same way.
You just have to. I mean, I think you go in there and you ask lots of questions and you write down the answers. And then when you get done, you just say, okay, well, I'm not interested in the paint protection. And obviously you already put it on there, but I don't want it. I park it in the garage and my wife waxes it every other Wednesday and I don't really need paint protection and I don't keep a car long enough for paint. I mean, those are the kinds of conversations. Right now is a good time to buy a car, because in the last 6 months and a year, they held the keys to all the new cars, and everybody that bought in the last year has paid a premium. Right now, because of the economy, and right now because of the abundance of cars, it is my opinion that the dealers are softening up on a lot of those ads. But you could also say, I want to order one, and I'll give you a down payment, and I want to order one just like that without all the stuff you did, and tell me how long it'll take to get it. And then they have a tough chance. Do they sell that discounted and eat a couple of those fancy-dancy window tints and smell good things, or do they just
right.
order
Two
you
minutes.
A new car? That's what I'd say. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Thanks much.
Okay, Keith, I'm going to throw Keith under the bus. Keith was my caller just before Jay, and the last thing he said was is he wanted to open up a GoFund account for Pete's Place. Folks, it's not polite to have a joke where just a couple of people get it, so I'm going to tell you what the joke is. Pete's Place is a bar in Star Valley. We keep our horses up in the Payson Star Valley area. I'm up there a lot. And Pete's Place is a well-known topless joint. And I remember that I had some of my son and a whole bunch of his friends, come over one night, and they were all going to Pete's Place. And the next morning I said to him, tell me what you experienced. And he says, it takes a lot to drink them pretty, Dad. And I laughed and I said, I don't know if it's true or not, but you behaved yourself and you know, all that stuff. And he said, yes. So he was referring to Pete's Place, and he was going to do a GoFundMe to help the girls at Pete's Place. So we can't have that kind of a joke where we just two of us know about it. And that's what it's all about. Anyway, Pete's Place is well known for those of you that pass through Payson on your way up the rim. It's because it's the bar that has a cow on the sign. A cow. And it used to be a butcher shop. And evidently there was some kind of a concoction in the city charter that if they took the sign down, then they had to rearrange some zoning. So anyway, they just opened up the bar and called Pete's Place, and there is a cow on the sign. Now the cow is full of arrows, because all the hunters that come up here will either on their way up stop at Pete's or on their way home stop. But the oftentimes the cow has so many arrows in it from the hunters that it looks like a porcupine. But there has been people that have come out of there that I know. I've never been in the place, I'm telling you that. But there's been people that come out of there that say, the cow is representative of the ladies inside, and then they also say the cow is not representative of the ladies inside. So in an effort to make this palatable to everybody, I've heard both sides of that. Nevertheless, 602-508-0960 is the phone number if you have a car question. 602-508-0960. And 0960 is easy, because this is 960 the Patriot. You know, there's a lot of shops in the valley right now that are just covered with cars. And it's an unfortunate situation. But if you live in the I-17 corridor in the north end, Action Auto Repairs at I-17 in Deer Valley. and he's on the northwest corner of I-17 in Deer Valley, and I've known Ton for a lot of time, years, and he's a good shop, and he runs a good, clean shop. South of him, a couple of miles, and one of his very best friends is Kurt from Kurt's Automotive. Kurt's is at I-17 and Bell Road. The two of them are really best of friends, but they're miles apart. But they work together. They like one another. They exchange information. Their staff knows one another, and that's what it's really all about. So if you're on the I-17 corridor, then you've got two different shops you can pick from. Kurt's Automotive, I-17 and Bell, or Action Automotive, I-17 and Deer Valley. And Martha, ladies first, how can I help you?
Mark, I'm getting ready to go on my first road trip alone. I'm going from Scottsdale to Williams.
Okay.
And this year, I put new tires on my car, has a brand new battery. I went and got my transmission serviced. And when I was talking to somebody about making this trip, they said, well, you need to get the car checked for a trip, the fluids, et cetera. So, Mark, what is et cetera, and can you just give me an idea of what a charge might be if I took it into a shop and said, could you get this? And if nothing was needed, but just a basic checkup charge at a shop.
When was the last oil change you had?
Just about a year ago.
Okay.
And I listened to you. I had them put the synthetic in.
Okay. I think you go back to them and you just say to them, I want an oil change without the oil and the filter, which gives you checking of all the fluids, the tires, the belts, the hoses, the brakes. That's what we do on an oil change. And so I if you have a relationship with them and they put synthetic oil in it, then you say the trip check is exactly the same list as what we do with an oil change. Now, keep in mind, you're coming in for an oil change, and we don't usually make a lot of money on an oil change because of market pricing. Well, that's the reason why we do such a good job in checking your car over, to try to sell you a tire rotation, to try to sell you a power steering hose that's leaking and stuff like that. That's part of the oil change, is this inspection. And the inspection should look forward however long the oil change is going to last. So in your case, 10 to 15,000 miles. So it's just go back to them and say to them, because you know, if you were my customer, that would be, come here, Eddie, would you look at her car and see if there's any problem with going to Williams? Thank you very much, Martha. Go ahead and just sit down. That's typically what they're going to do. They're just going to say, we understand. We'll do that for you right now. It's fluids, belts, hoses, tires, and anything obvious. That's it. That's all we're interested in. Fluids, belts, hoses, and tires. And anything obvious, and that's all you need. Okay?
Very good. Thanks, Mark.
Oh, you're welcome. Tom, you're up next. How can I help you?
Yeah, hi. I've got a new Toyota pickup truck, new to me, a Tundra, that takes 0-20 oil. It's due for a change, and I have a box of 5-20 oil, full synthetic here. The very cheapness of me says I should use the 5-20.
You know what?
What do you think?
You and I are cut from the same cloth. First of all, your motor's never going to know the difference. Never, never, never. So let me explain. A 0-20 flows like a zero weight below freezing, and it flows like a 20 weight on the top end, on a hot. So the zero, it flows like a 0-8 when it's cold and flows like a 20-8 when it's hot. Your motor's not going to give a damn whether you got a 5-20 in there or a 0-20. It doesn't make any difference. And your oil, your synthetic oil, doesn't even turn to a tar at 60 below zero. Or not tar, a solid. I misspoke. It turned to a solid. It'll turn to wax at 60 below, and I'm pretty sure you're not going anywhere where it's 60 below. And the 20 part of it flows like a 20 weight when it's hot, and a synthetic, it doesn't turn to a tar at 500 degrees, and it does turn to a tar at 500, but your motor's trashed at 320. It's gone. So you see the difference? So use the 520 and move on, okay?
All right. Thank you for the help.
Oh, you're welcome. Steve, you're up next. How can I help you?
A disclaimer at the very outset. I don't know anything about fixing cars. I love your show because I feel like a blind squirrel, and every now and then I run across a nut. And just like the nuts you just came about, the different oil weights and things. But anyhow, and changing the oil synthetic every 10 or 15,000 miles has saved me a fortune, I'm guessing, over time. But anyhow, I have a question. I don't know how to think through this. I had a 2015 Toyota Prius. I put 326,000 miles on it, following your advice of oil changes, when they're due, and rotating tires and all of the rest of that stuff. I also put some stuff in the gas tank. I don't know if that helped or not. But anyhow, it lasted until 326,000 miles, and then the head gaskets went along with, I guess, the engine. So I traded it in and have another car. It doesn't matter what that is right now. But the dilemma that I have is, with Prius is getting such great gas mileage, I'm thinking I want to go back to that junk car and people think it just was breaking the car too.
Okay.
So, are there things that could go wrong with the car that would make that a stupid move?
Well, is the gist of this is to put another motor in it, in the one that's got the bad motor?
Yeah, that's it. Okay. That's what my thought is.
Okay. Well, 320,000 miles is 12 times around the equator. I think you got your money out of it. And I want to tell you that every motor we replace has been damaged by the nut behind the wheel. It's either been run low on oil or it's been overheated. Every motor we replace has been damaged by whoever's hands were on the steering wheel. And that's sometimes they fight between a husband and a wife. But it's just you. There's cars out there that are 3 and 4 and 500,000 miles that haven't been overheated, haven't been run low on oil. Maybe they're a little loose in the morning. Maybe they use a little oil. Maybe they leak a little oil. But most, as it is Mark Salem's opinion, that 99 out of 100 engines that go to engine heaven are damaged by the nut behind the wheel. And that's just all there is to it. So if you don't overheat it, you don't run it low on oil, you stay on top of your oil changes, and don't do too many. If it's a 3,000-mile call, then don't do 1,500 miles. 3,000 is okay. If you're going to use a synthetic and the manual calls for it, then do what the manual says. And people over-maintain their car because they think that the car is going to love them more and that they're going to last forever, and nothing could be further from the truth. So don't over-maintain your car. Just maintain the car, and I agree with you. Okay, thank you very much. That was a very nice compliment you paid me, and that was Steve. No, that was Steve. I need to go to Wilson. Wilson, you're up next. How can I help you?
Yes. I have a Pontiac G3 09, and my compressor went out. So I took it to a GMC dealer on Bell Road, West Bell Road, and they went ahead and replaced the compressor, and then 3 days later, it stopped working again. So they replaced the expansion valve and charged me something like $2,500. And I asked them, did you flush the system? No. Did you change the dryer? No. We don't need to. What do you think of that?
I'd be very disappointed if my staff, if that came out of their mouth. The expansion valve or the orifice tube is something that you pull apart and you look at it, and it kind of tells you what happened. If it's full of metal, it's because the compressor came apart and plugged it completely. The expansion valve has specific symptoms, but a customer's never come into my shop and said, hey, I want you to check my expansion valve. That's craziness. Our responsibility is to put the car back the way it was, as close to new as we can. And after you take your 09 into them, the car is old. The engine's old. And I can't imagine why somebody didn't replace the orifice tube as part of the compressor replacement and the dryer. Those are industry standards. Those are things we're supposed to do. The dryer is supposed to can gather up contaminants as well as any moisture in the system, and the expansion valve is a filter to not let any metal that's come from the compressor go back to the compressor. So I don't understand. I understand why you're unhappy, and I don't blame you a bit, but I think the idea that we just replace the compressor and that's all the General Motors manual said to do is flat bull excrement. Does that make sense?
You know
what I'd do if I were you? This is kind of underhanded. I would call the dealership and pretend I was someone else and say to them, you know, I got this car and I took it to a shop down the road from you and I did the air conditioning compressor and and tell them the same story and let's see if their spokesman, the person on the phone, throws trash at the supposed shop that they think is not them. And let's see if they'll say, oh, no, they should have done the orifice tube. They should have flushed that system. What are you talking about? And you go, okay, well, thank you. What's your name again? Okay, thank you. And then go back and talk to the service manager and see what he says. That's the only offer I can offer you.
Well, I did talk to the service manager, and he gave me the same story. Well, okay. You know, if we do that, it's going to cost more money. And replace the compressor labor, they charged me $700. Replace the suspension valve and labor was $1,100.
Okay.
That makes sense?
No, but I'd like to see the paperwork and I'd like to see the VIN and I'd like to see the pricing and stuff, but no, that doesn't make sense. You know, if you want to fight the battle and you've already gone to the service manager, you're kind of at the end of the day. You can go write a bunch of bad reviews on them and stuff, or you can call another dealership and pretend that the first shop you're talking about is an independent shop. So don't say the other dealer did this. Say, oh, ABC Automotive, and it's run by an independent guy down here. He did this, this, and this, and he said, no, we don't do that. And then this other dealer that's across town of the same vintage of the car you got says, no, that's craziness. No, you need to flush it. You need to do the orifice tube. And so you write down all that information, and you go back to the first service manager, and you say, you know what? Your counterpart across the city here says that the information you gave me isn't correct, and here's what he said. That's just playing dirty. If you want to play dirty, then play dirty. But I think here's another way to look at it. He cost you some money, but you found out he's an idiot. If what you represent is the truth, he's an idiot. That's not what our industry is all about. And I don't care what they say. I don't care how they manufacture that. When we do air conditioning work, there is a process that involves a long set of circumstances to make sure that what happened to you doesn't happen to our customers. So flushing the system and replacing the orifice tube and replacing the dryer and all that kind of stuff is part of a compressor replacement. And if you don't do it and you cut corners, then you're going to see the customer back. And they're going to be mad at you. So that's how it works. I got to run, Wilson. God bless you, buddy. And good luck. My email address is mark@marksalem.com, and you're welcome to send me an email if you have any questions. And if you'll give me a phone number, I usually call back, but I'm on a blocked line for obvious reasons. So I will tell you, I'm going to call you back in the next couple of hours, and I'm going to come through as a blocked line, and you can do that. Automatic Transmission Exchange is at 40th Street in Washington, and he's the only shop in Phoenix that I can recommend. He knows transmissions inside and out, left, right, Chevys, Fords, Hondas, Toyotas, all that kind of stuff. He is really, really good at what he does. And then you got Larry Harker's Auto at 38th Avenue and Indian School, and he's fixed cars for me. I can't tell you how many times, in the sense that I've got a customer or a caller in that geographical area. And so I send them to Harker's, and they fix it. And I really like that. We've talked about Strictly Diesel Service and Repair. Nate's a great guy up there. If you have a diesel and you're up near I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road, Nate's your guy. Cut and dried, Nate's your guy at Strictly Diesel. And Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing is the only place in Mesa I can recommend for you. It's because I'm pretty specific about who I want on my best car repair shops list. And Brian and Thelma deserve to be there. They have an absolute perfect record. And all you have to do is shake their hand and meet them to understand why Mark Salem really does love Brian and Thelma from Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. Oh, my email address again is mark@marksalem.com. Thank you for spending your Saturday with me. And next Saturday, I'll see you here from 10 to noon.